Hello and welcome to this building podcast. I'm Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. Coming up in this episode.
And they said it would demean the Tower of London to the status of a toy castle.
Plans for a 305-metre observation tower in London is sparking controversy. Why is everyone so heated up? Also on the show.
And ultimately, therefore, ends up being, in most cases, I understand it, burnt.
Construction generates an estimated 50,000 tonnes of plastic packaging waste each year. So what are we doing about it? Stick around. First up today, after the collapse of contractor Carillion in January 2018, a number of subcontractors, workers and schemes were left wondering what's next. Two of these schemes were major new hospitals, the Midland Metropolitan and the Royal Liverpool. With these sites left abandoned for months, work is just now restarting, leaving both multiple years behind schedule. Our feature in Building this week looks at the human cost of Carillion's demise, as well as the future of these troubled projects. Joining me in the studio today is Jordan Marshall, Building's news correspondent. So Jordan, it's been a long year for both of these sites. What's the latest?
Yeah, it has been a really long road to getting them back on track, if that's what you can call it at this point at all. But I suppose the latest from a Midland Metropolitan sort of perspective is that they are trying to appoint a new contractor, which that appointment's meant to be made in the summer. Which means that there will have been pretty much 18 months between having a proper main contractor working on that job, which is crazy. But Balfour Beatty has been on that project since November doing some early works to sort of restore the site because it was left open to the elements and get things ready. So when the contractor is appointed, they can hopefully hit the ground running and get this one done by 2022. It's a bit of a different story at Royal Liverpool because that project, which I actually went and visited last January, not long after Carillion went bust, looked pretty weatherproof and it looked essentially like a nice new building sitting in the middle of a construction site. But our feature has discovered that apparently there are more than 80 defects with that scheme. We've been hearing that an Arup structural review has found issues with ventilation in the operating theatres. The issues with the structural beams are quite well known. Richard Howson told MPs in the weeks following Carillion's collapse. The cladding's non-compliant. There's all sorts of problems. So Philang O'Rourke is the replacement contractor on that one. They have to try and sort out the mess that was left behind.
So it's not the case that they were just left abandoned. It was also the fact that there were quite a lot of underlying issues anyway prior to the collapse.
That definitely seems the case at the Royal Liverpool. Middle of Met, we haven't heard so much about issues with the work that had already been done, but there had been less work already done. So it's hard to say whether if they'd had a bit more time on it, it might have ended up in worse condition, I suppose. But there does seem to have been some serious problems with the Royal Liverpool, which is probably reflected in the fact that it was already late when Carillion went bust. It was meant to open in 2017, and now it doesn't look likely to open before the end of 2020. That's when everyone's saying at the moment, but Lango Rock still has to come up with a plan to get it there. So
wow. Okay, so, I mean, we're talking not just a slight delay of, what, 18 months, but even longer because of the changes that might be, you know, required. So, I mean, when Carillion collapsed as well, we heard some quite interesting anecdotal stories regarding just, you know, things just not quite finishing. You know, people stopping on site, but other things were happening as well.
Yes, there's a really good story in this week's feature from one of the subcontractors who says that he saw people essentially realising they weren't going to get paid, subcontractors going onto site, ripping stuff out that they'd just fitted because they knew they were never going to get paid for the work or the materials. And, you know, saw people walking off site with copper pipes in hand, which is a crazy story, but kind of understandable if you know that you never
get paid. You can see where they're coming from, can't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you know, all of these changes, you mentioned that, you know, that Lange Rort's got to get a plan for one of these, you know, a new plan for sort of finishing this. And the defects as well of not helping things that you mentioned as well, there might be changes to things like floor plans.
Yeah, so in public board documents that have been published, they're published every month by the NHS Trusts of both hospitals. But for the Royal Liverpool, they've said that they've had MBBJ, who was one of the architects in the Royal Liverpool, working with ARIP, and Mace, who was project managing there for 6 months, only ever on a temporary basis, and now Gleeds, who's taken over from Mace, looking at the potentially having to rejig some floor plans and stuff. There haven't been details of whether they're going to have to do that or anything, but it's not great if you're having to rejig an essentially already built hospital.
Yes, yeah, that's not great at all. In terms of, I mean, obviously all of this is going to cost quite a lot as well. How were they funded originally, and how has that changed since Carillion's demise?
So they were both PFI hospitals. They were being built using PFI vehicles, and they were originally, the Royal Liverpool was meant to cost £335 million. Carillion was paid £114 million. And so far, there hasn't really been any update on what they're expecting it to cost to finish. And that's probably because they're still finding issues with the project, and they've got to put a new business case to government next month. So that's going to be interesting for them. And I suppose in time, that will become clear how much finishing that hospital is going to cost. At the other hospital, they've spent £13 million on Balfour Beatty, trying to get that finished, fixed. And then they've already paid £204 million to Carillion. It was originally meant to cost £297 million. So they paid a bulk of it to Carillion. And they're saying that it'll cost up to £320 million to actually get the Midland Met finished, which is insane. It's a crazy amount of money.
So that is more than what they've already paid so far to try and get it finished, so...
Yep, it's more than what they've already paid so far, and it's more than what they were originally expecting the total cost to be.
Astronomical figures. So what's next, basically? We've got these eventually starting work again on these sites. What's next for them?
So I suppose the next thing at Royal Liverpool will be the Lango Rock program plan, which will come this month, is when it's expected. Then the following month, they're expected to submit a new business case to Department for Health and Social Care, who'll be financing this, both schemes now. And I guess they just have to cross all their fingers and toes that nothing goes wrong and they get the money that they need. And then at the other hospital, they're creating a shortlist, which they're expecting that sort of be confirmed in the next few weeks, of contractors, and with an appointment to come in July, with work coming, restarting soon after that. They've got the financing sorted there, at least with government. It's probably more of a known quantity. They sort of know what they're dealing with there, know the work that has to be done, whereas they're still finding work they have to do with the other one. So they've both got their problems, but they're quite distinct and different problems, which I suppose will keep the story going.
Yeah, we'll keep it going, and we'll keep tabs on it. Okay, Jordan Marshall, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And you can read more on the plight of these hospitals at building.co.uk. Still to come on this episode, how construction is battling to tackle plastic waste. But first, a proposed tower for the City of London, which has sparked outrage. The Tulip is the name that's been given to a new controversial observation tower planned for the City of London. Designed by Foster and Partners, the proposed scheme would stand next to the Gherkin and would be the tallest within the square mile. But why has there been such an uproar? Joining me is Jim Dunton, a contributor to Building's sister title, BD, and Ike EJ, Building's architectural correspondent. So, Jim, how did this story come about?
Absolutely. Well, readers of Building and BD will be very, very familiar with the great source of stories that the Tulip has been in recent weeks and months. But in November, pretty much like a bolt from the blue, a planning application went into the City of London that is for a scheme by Foster and Partners, which is a practice we're very interested in. They come up with groundbreaking designs. They designed the Gherkin in the City of London. And this scheme is basically for a tourist attraction that will be one of the city's tallest buildings, if not the tallest building in the city. And it's right next to the Gherkin. It's 305 metres tall, I think.
About 5 metres shorter than the Shard.
Yeah, yeah. I think it will be the tallest structure, or there'll be no taller structure on the north side of the river. And it's, yeah, it's a tourist attraction. It looks like a bauble on a pole. It's a sort of a contributory structure to the Gherkin. It's yeah, 12 stories of viewing area and facilities on top of a concrete shaft.
But there was some immediate backlash to the story, was there not?
Well, I think any tall building in the City of London is going to have an impact on its surroundings, and people are entitled to particularly relevant and interested parties like Historic England, like bodies that protect historic sites such as historic royal palaces, are all entitled to have a say on new structures. And those groups are, yeah, flexing their muscles and offering their opinions. Historic England, which is the government's heritage advisor, has basically objected to the scheme primarily because of its impact on the Tower of London. Historic Royal Palaces, which is the custodian of the Tower of London, has also objected. The Mayor of London's Greater London Authority Planners has raised some objections. Their concerns are about the amount of viewing space for school students. Part of the offer of this attraction is that about 20,000 school children from public schools in London, that is rather state schools in London, will be able to view the city from this new attraction should it get built every year. They'll be able to do that. The GLA raised some concerns. They've raised concerns about queuing. The City of London's own built environment people have also raised concerns about the impact at street level these plans will have, because I think it's something in the region of 1 million visitors every year that the project team is expecting will make use of it. So yeah, there's also a queue of people objecting to it.
Ike, you've written a piece in Building magazine this week just on this issue. Are people right to be outraged by this?
Well, yeah, they are. Yes, as Jim said, the Tulip proposals have been very controversial for a number of reasons, but it does also expose some of the hypocrisies in the way in which we progress planning, particularly in the City of London, but in a way which could apply to London as a whole or even the country as a whole. Now, without being too pejorative, the first thing to establish about this scheme, this proposal, is that it is utterly ridiculous. There is no need for it in London. It will trivialise and further make irrelevant London's skyline. And certainly from my point of view, clearly it's my own point of view, it's not shared by BB or Building or anybody else, but this is an unnecessary piece of architecture which will do harm to London, in my view. But that said, I don't think there's much basis, in fact, for much of the opposition that's been levied against the Tulip so far. And by that I mean, for instance, Historic England and Historic Royal Palaces have grumbled about the height of the building. They said it's too tall. This has also been a criticism from the GLA as well. Fair enough, you could say it's too tall, but particularly from the GLA, it does make you wonder, this building, if built, will only be 36 centimetres taller than a building very close by called the Undershaft, which is by another architect called Eric Parry. If the Undershaft sailed through planning, didn't have any controversy, and was presumably fine from a statutory point of view, and it's only 36 centimetres shorter than the Tulip, then why is the Tulip causing so much controversy? Either we have a proper, decent skyline, high tall building planning policy in this city, or we don't. So height is the first issue in which you can maybe quibble with the statutory and complaints that have been levied so far. The other is heritage. Now, with very good reason, Historic England and, as Jim said, Historic Royal Palaces have been furious about this building. They think it would further destabilise the heritage of the City of London. The Historic Royal Palaces used a wonderful term. They said it would demean the Tower of London to the status of a toy castle. Now, I agree with all of that. I think it's true. But it's a bit rich at this stage when there are so many other towers in the City of London. Unfortunately, I'm not saying it's Historic Royal Palace's fault, I think the Tower of London's toy castle status was pretty much confirmed quite a few years ago. So there's definitely an argument for saying it's maybe a bit, we're definitely in kind of closing stable door after horses bolted territory already. My final gripe, just before I leave office, the other ground on which the Tulip has been criticised, this comes from the GLO, Jim also mentioned, was an issue of public realm. Incredibly, this kind of thing can only happen in London. Basically, the City of London, in the biggest city in Europe, the centre, the historic centre of the City of London, has said it doesn't think its streets can handle queues of tourists. Now, just analyse that comment. This is a capital city of the United Kingdom. The City of London is awash with tourist attractions. As Jim said, there's an estimated 1 million tourists who potentially could visit the Tulip every year. If the city can't handle that, then maybe we should demolish St. Paul's Cathedral, which has 2 million visitors every year, and move that to another part of the city where the public realm can more readily accommodate queues of tourists. I mean, to claim that a city such as London does not have a public realm or public street or streetscape that can accommodate tourists is probably the most ridiculous assertion I've heard coming out of the City of London in a very long time. And there is stiff competition for that accolade.
Yeah, I think from a journalistic point of view, every time someone's got an objection to the Tulip or even words in favour of it, and there are supportive comments in the City of London's planning system, I think you've got to weigh them on balance. And I can pretty easily see planning officers coming out in support of the Tulip. There's economic supporting data that says it will create 600 jobs, it will generate 1.6 billion, I think is the biggest number in their economic assessment for the London economy over the course of 27 years. And at some point, this is going to go before planners, and I think they can probably find a way around every objection that's come into it. So, you know, I would expect planners to advise it to be approved, and then it will be up to members of the City of London's Planning and Transportation Committee to decide whether or not they want to agree with that. That would be my prediction.
I agree with Jim. I'd be stunned if this doesn't get approved, to be honest. I'll eat my hat, yet down style, if this doesn't get approved by the city.
I mean, it might be a protracted thing. I mean, they might well have to go back to the drawing board with some of the sort of the lower level elements of the scheme to accommodate the extra visitors. I think the built environment people were pretty clear that they had strong concerns, but I don't think those are concerns that can't be addressed. And it might be with a bit of extra design. Astonishingly, and this is not only the Tulip, but with general objections on historic grounds, you can look at a letter and go, wow, this will never get approved. Look at what historic England thinks. And then the fact that all of their concerns don't quite go high enough on the red line meter to be substantial damage.
Exactly.
And nothing that I've read from Historic England about this scheme says this is going to cause substantial damage to views of the Tower of London, which will basically mean that planners can go, oh, it's more really.
Absolutely.
Have we got some kind of timeline or a rough timeline in place for when we're expecting this to sort of go through planning? Do you know?
It's subject to a special kind of agreement, which means that the developers have agreed a path with the City of London that says we think you can deal with this in acceptable time limits, and I don't know what those figures are. When it initially went in for planning, I think there was a suggestion that it could be determined, so it could go before that committee of the City of London next month at some point. It could be March, and I think it might have been sort of the early half of March, but there might be a deal between the developers and the City of London, which would be perfectly legitimate to say, look, you know, as long as you need, we'll be fine. And if they decide they need to make some more tweaks to satisfy their own built environment people, it could be another month, 2 months on top of that. It could be longer, but it should be this year sometime. It might be quickly.
The City of London itself, there are all these sort of space constraints. It's a very sort of tight, packed area.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that sort of come into, you know, is London unusual, or central, the City of London unusual for having these constraints? And do they feed into things like the planning process or the approval process for things like this? Do other cities have these kind of qualms, or is it just because London is such a old city with a lot of creaking buildings and windy streets?
I think the UK planning system is different to other countries' planning systems, although there are similarities with Commonwealth nations. And also the layout of the city is perhaps, you know, even different to other parts of London. I mean, there are windy streets in the city that there aren't so many of in bits of Westminster. And
the City of London, it is unique. as Jim said, even compared to other parts of London, it's a very organic streetscape. Despite all the modern buildings, it's essentially a medieval street pattern, mm. which has never changed in hundreds and hundreds of years. But again, going back to that public realm argument, yes, there will be challenges to have streams of tourists gathering at a particular location. But again, look at the huge office towers which have permission or which have been built near the city, very close to the Tulip, spewing out thousands of office workers every day. Mm. Nobody grumbles about that. The City of London say, we can't handle all these new towers because we can't accommodate all these people. People are people, whether they're tourists or office workers, and if a city like London can't accommodate that, then I think it's a very sorry state of affairs.
You know, we both expect it to get planning permission, but will it get built?
I imagine it will do. If it gets planning permission, I mean, the money's not going to be short. The Safra is behind it, who is a billionaire, tons of money. Foster and Partners are also behind it as well. I don't see how it wouldn't get built if it did get planning permission, but you never know. The City of London is littered with buildings that did get planning permission but were never built.
Jim, Ike, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
You can read Ike's piece in full on the arguments for and against the Tulip at building.co.uk. And finally, sustainability is always somewhere on the agenda in the built environment. And now the spotlight is being shone on the mountain of plastic waste that the construction industry generates. But what are construction firms doing to reduce this, and what more can be done? The Considerate Constructor Scheme has this week launched a campaign to tackle this issue. Joining me is Edward Hardy, the Considerate Constructor Scheme's Chief Executive. Edward, thanks for joining me.
Not a problem. Nice to talk to you, Jamie.
So, Edward, plastic packaging waste is a huge issue for everyone, obviously, but why should construction really be concerned about its contribution?
From the data we've looked at and from researching the subject, as we're all aware, it's a subject that's really come to the fore more recently, specifically because of David Attenborough's TV show, which most of us saw and were appalled by in terms of the impact. So looking into the subject more deeply with our role within construction, it would appear that the construction industry is one of the largest, possibly the second largest consumer of plastic within the UK. And we've got that information from RAP. And the volumes are huge, obviously, as the second largest consumer, with the industry using about 23% of all plastics produced in the UK. So with those figures in mind, one would assume a large or at least a proportion or a percentage of that will end up as waste, and therefore it's absolutely the responsibility of the industry to do all it can to reduce and minimise any waste it is causing from plastics. Where the key problem comes, as we all understand, is that material, plastic as we're talking about now, it's where that material then can't be reused or repurposed and recycled, and ultimately therefore ends up being, in most cases, I understand it, burnt. And whether that is the most efficient thing to do with a material that we're using for a specific purpose. And we'd argue the scheme that probably isn't the most efficient thing that can be done. And you know, we and the industry should therefore be doing all we can to look to doing things differently for want of a better outcome.
So yeah, I mean, there are plenty of things that people can do differently, and this is part of the Considerate Constructor Scheme's campaign into sort of plastics and packaging. I mean, that is setting out to sort of make some recommendations for contractors and people working on site. What sort of recommendations, you know, what can businesses do really to reduce this?
It's a vast and complicated subject, yes. As we all appreciate. Wouldn't it be lovely if there was a single answer that would encapsulate everything? But now I think the simplicity of it is, it's like all of these things, and our position as the Considerate Constructor Scheme within this is simply to, I suppose it was twofold really, it's to shine a light on the subject and to raise awareness and understanding about what that subject is and why it's important. And secondly, to then highlight where we can, what best practice looks like, and what the most enlightened companies and organisations are doing themselves to address this. What we don't do is come up with the solutions ourselves. That's not our position. But what we will do very proactively, and what we've done through this campaign and will continue to do, is highlight what the very best are doing in the real world, republish that information and back to the sector to say, look, this is how others are able to address this subject to the highest possible standards. And we would then recommend, of course, that they consider doing likewise. So we won't give the solution, but we will point people to where they can find the solution for themselves.
Sure. And there are, you know, examples of obviously firms doing very good things as well in the industry already, which is obviously, you know, part of your campaign to amplify that. I mean, in terms of obviously there are sort of, you know, little bits of advice and things which could be seen as marginal gains to eventually reduce that. I mean, do contractors generally, you know, set themselves, or are they set targets for reducing plastics, or is there, you know, a benchmark to aim for, or?
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's something we're also looking into as the considerate constructor scheme, is should we as an organisation look to set some sort of standards that the industry can aim to achieve? And you know, we're looking into that as we speak. But yes, what we're seeing is, since this issue all blew up, and it has sort of blown up, hasn't it? It's something that, you know, yes, it's something we and the industry have always been aware of, and the industry has always worked hard to minimise waste, for the right reasons, but also for the financial reasons. You know, waste is cost, and therefore, you know, you don't want to create any waste, whatever it is. But, you know, what we have seen over the last, you know, 6 months, 12 months potentially, and also since we as a scheme have introduced this more specifically into our checklist at the start of this year, which admittedly is only a couple of months now, but we are seeing more and more companies now explaining to us, when we're monitoring them, that they do have in place now specific policies around plastics, but more specifically packaging. So what most of them are saying is, actually, packaging is the issue they're looking at, and plastics is one type of packaging. You know, you can waste lots of materials, not just plastic. So most companies, you know, the vast majority of companies we're looking at now do have in place, or are putting in place, very specific policies and procedures to address the subject of unnecessary waste. And I think it is that simple, really.
One of the interesting things that because I was reading your best practice piece, and it's, you know, there are a lot of you know, bits of information there which are obviously relevant to the sector. But one of the interesting things I found was that you mentioned that formulating a site waste management plan, it used to be a legal requirement in England, and obviously this is no longer the case. I mean, is this having an impact? Is this making it less important, or less of a, you know, top of the agenda, I guess, for firms? I mean, including obviously the packaging stuff as well, in, you know, embedded within that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't see the subject becoming less important. Far from it. Actually, we see the subject becoming more important, and the broader subject about environmental impact, and that includes waste and so on. So, yes, the fact that it's no longer a legal requirement, of course, everyone was concerned that that would cause a negative impact, but we're not seeing that. You know, the vast majority, you know, 90%+ of the industry that we're monitoring still has white waste management plans in place, and are doing huge amounts to address all they can to reduce any form of waste and to have less of an environmental impact, which waste obviously falls part of. So yeah, we haven't seen firsthand any decrease in commitment by the industry that we're monitoring to want to do all they can to be, well, create as little waste as they can is the first ambition, but then to do, when waste is created, to do the right thing with it.
Okay. What would success look like for this campaign? You know, you've done other sort of spotlight campaigns in the past looking at some of the issues big contractors face, such as air pollution, etc. I mean, first of all, what sort of impact have those had? And secondly, what would success look like for this campaign in particular?
Sure. Well, specifically, I mean, what would success look like for this campaign? What we don't judge the campaign on is it in itself being successful, because that doesn't interest us in the slightest. What we're interested in is the impact the campaign has. That's what's important to us. So success for us would be, I suppose, a noticeable marked change in how the industry deals with single-use materials and the wastage of them, and plastic specifically. So if the result and the success, and how we judge the success of this campaign, is that, you know, when we're looking at the industry and having these conversations 6-12 months from now, there's a marked improvement in how single-use plastic specifically, but generally waste, is being managed and dealt with. So the campaign in itself is simply a vehicle, if you will, to highlight an issue and to help people decide for themselves what to do about it. So, yeah, success is real-world change in behaviours within the construction industry, and a move and an understanding, I suppose, within the industry that this is a subject that we should be doing all we can to address, and as an industry should be absolutely at the forefront of best practice when addressing this.
Okay. Final question, Edward. I appreciate that obviously yours is your campaign is about awareness and ensuring best practice is sort of followed and adhered to. But do you feel the industry needs a bit of legislation or some maybe a government vehicle which has a bit of teeth to enforce such a change, or is it purely a case of behavioural change? It will come over time.
Our stance always is legislation achieves an outcome, but it's a bit of a blunt instrument. Our stance as a scheme, and our stance as the scheme has always been, that the industry is more than able and capable and self-willing to want to change and improve itself through vehicles like the Considerate Constructor Scheme and our ability to encourage and motivate the industry to do things. So should it be legislated or not? Yes. Whatever ultimately solves the problem that is being created in whatever way, shape or form. But I believe that right-minded, sensible individuals, as there are working in the industry, are more than able to understand the subject and the issue and are more than willing and able and committed to addressing it.
Edward Hardy, thanks for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Jamie.
You can read the guidance in full at ccsbestpractice.org.uk, and you can read Building's feature in full on our website. That's all we've got time for on this podcast, and indeed for this mini-series. Let us know what you liked about these podcasts by emailing building@building.co.uk with the subject line podcast, or leave us a review on iTunes. We're also eager to hear your thoughts on podcast length and frequency, as well as what you'd like to hear on future episodes, whether that's more discussion on a particular topic, interviews with industry figures, or discussion in a different format. Don't forget you can listen back to any of our previous episodes on our website at building.co.uk/podcasts or via your preferred podcast app, where you can hear analysis and discussion on a range of topics from Brexit to Crossrail, Interserve and more. Thanks for downloading Building Podcasts. I'm Jamie Harris. Until next time.